From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The caravan of refugees waiting at the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana is dominated by Hondurans. There's a good reason for that. The Central American nation of Honduras has become an increasingly violent place, plagued by state repression and paramilitary forces. But it's also a country where resistance has a long history, and a powerful protest movement has been pushing back. Most importantly, and this is a fact that is often obscured in media coverage in the U.S., the United States has played a critical role in undermining democracy in Honduras for years now. My guest is Dana Frank, professor of history emerita at the University of California in Santa Cruz. She's the author of numerous books, including Banana Neras, Women Transforming the Banana Unions of Latin America, as well as Buy American, The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, and many other books. Since the 2009 military coup in Honduras, her articles about human rights and U.S. policy in Honduras have appeared in The Nation magazine, New York Times, Politico, ForeignAffairs.com, ForeignPolicy.com, the LA Times, Miami Herald, and more. And she now joins me to discuss her newest book. It's called The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Welcome to the program, Dana.
Oh, thanks so much. It's such an honor to be on the show.
Thank you very much for joining us. So that coup that took place now nearly 10 years ago, 9 years ago, is one that marked a major turning point in Honduras. And everything that's been happening over the last 9 years, we could say is what has led up to what we see is this exodus from Honduras, or rather the exodus from Honduras is one outcome of everything that's transpired, right? Can you give us a brief summary for those who hadn't been aware of what happened in 2009, of how a democratically elected government with U.S. support was toppled from power?
Well, it's not like there was a golden age before the coup, but it was certainly there was a stable economy. There was the somewhat semblance of the rule and law, and there was people was not massive poverty, even though there was plenty of poverty. And that coup, which overthrew democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya, is really what opened the door to this destruction of the rule of law and mass poverty that we've seen the outcome of now and have for 10 years. Zelaya was the deposed president, was a centrist. He was moving slightly to the left, and the U.S. didn't even want to tolerate that. And so there was this military coup with the backing of the Supreme Court and the majority of the Honduran Congress that overthrew him on June 28, 2009. So what we're seeing now is the long arc of the destruction of the government, the destruction of daily life in Honduras, and this massive wave of violence. But it's not like, as I keep saying, it's not a natural disaster what's happened to Honduras. It's a product of a political process in which criminals took over the government. They've been running it ever since. They're tied in with drug traffickers and gangs at the highest level, and they're profiting from this, and the U.S. has been backing them ever since.
So remind us of the role that the United States played in 2009, because we see over and over again this kind of narrative from the right, from anti-immigrant forces here in the U.S., that, you know, Hondurans need to just fix their own country. Just because their country is broken doesn't mean that they should be coming here. Why don't they just remain there and fix things? So they completely obscure the U.S. role, don't they?
Well, and also that plays into a long racist stereotype that somehow, quote unquote, the little brown people can't govern themselves, when in fact it's the United States that for over a century has dominated Honduran politics and stopped any semblance of sovereignty. And that's what the coup was all about. The U.S. backed the post-coup government very quickly. It treated the post-coup dictator as an equal to the democratically elected president. It played out negotiations after the coup that would have led to the president returning to his own country, and then recognized a bogus election a few months later, calling Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, called it something to the effect of a beautiful example of democracy in action. So it was very overt, the U.S. support for the outcome of that. And clearly the U.S. wanted to have the coup stabilized, and it threw a lot of people off guard. And since then, the U.S. has continued to recognize, support, and even celebrate repressive governments, particularly in the last 5 years of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who stole money from the government, from the National Health Service, to pay for his 2013 campaign, and then ran illegally in 2017 in violation of the Constitution and then stole the election last November. So the U.S. continues to act like this is a legitimate government. If you want to see the continuity, John Kelly, who is currently Trump's chief of staff, was head of the United States Southern Command. That means all the U.S. military for Latin America before. And he said that Juan Orlando Hernandez, the dictator, was, quote unquote, doing a magnificent job of fighting drugs. And he has recently said that Juan Orlando was a great guy and a good friend. So it's not just the Trump administration. It's not just the Obama administration. It's not just Hillary Clinton. It's this long continuity of U.S. celebration of this repressive dictatorship.
Right. The Democrats and Republicans differ in a lot of things, and on some things they don't differ at all, Honduras being one of them, and in many foreign policy issues actually being among them. Now, in the aftermath of the coup, as you write in your book, you've met with a lot of ordinary Hondurans as well as people who are active in resistance movements there. What is life like? What was life like in those early years? And can you give us some stories of the kinds of things that people experienced that were really quite devastating as people tried to overturn the coup and the post-coup government, you know, responded quite violently?
Thanks. You know, I do want to clarify something. Maybe we can talk about it later. But there are 71 Democratic members of Congress that are on record saying we should suspend police and military aid to Honduras. So a lot of this Democratic opposition.
That's heartening. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the Democratic opposition has been not reported at all by the media. And also in the Senate, Senators Leahy, Cardin, Markey, Merkley have been really wonderful. So that's part of the story we don't hear. But, you know, to talk about the resistance after the coup, and it's part of what I wanted the reader to feel in the first chapter of the book, that it's not just unrelenting horror out down there. There are repeated and gorgeous and ongoing resistance movements in which you just see the most beautiful outpouring of joy in life and bravery, and particularly in the 2 years after the coup, the National Front of Popular Resistance came together, and it was like our own fantasy coalition that no one expected, of the labor movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, the Campesina movement, the Afro-Indigenous movement, and the Indigenous peoples movements, as well as a lot of middle-class people committed to the rule of law and constitutional order, which of course is something that now resonates in the United States. And that resistance culture, you know, Honduras was never the cool place to be part of the left or the opposition before the coup. And it was an amazing thing. And part of what I talk about in the book is I want the reader to feel what it was like to be in the streets with these people and their sense of humor, renaming a river that was known as Rio Tufoso, which means stinky river, calling it Rio Micheletti after the president.
Right, you know, he was the post-coup president, Micheletti, yeah.
Yeah, you know, amazing graffiti, such as my personal favorite, the cardinal who supported the coup is still the cardinal, charged with corruption now by many, nadie ama al pisto como el cardinal ama al pisto, which translates as no one loves Christ like the cardinal loves cash. Mm. And that rhymes. And, you know, just this joyous sense of being in the streets and feeling people's power. And people bring toddlers, old people come in wheelchairs. It was just like, just if you're going to kill us, just kill us. But here we are in the streets, and we believe in that. And in the face of tear gas, we're seeing a lot about tear gas in the United States now, and U.S. Shooting tear gas into Mexico. But boy, my friends used to joke that you could taste three different kinds of tear gas. They were getting so used to it. And ongoing repression when the Hungarian government is tear gassing peaceful demonstrations. So, but what disappears the story is like this joy and struggle, as well as incredible bravery, because hundreds of people were killed, thousands of human rights abuses, almost all of which remains in impunity. And also this slow-moving massacre of campesino activists in the Aguan Valley trying to reclaim collective lands when they were forced off their land by palm oil elites. Who found palm oil. And, you know, that story of the Aguan Valley and the fact that people are still bravely reoccupying land to this day. And so it's not just a story of victims, and that's part of the problem with the U.S. reporting, is it becomes sort of a victim narrative, not just about 2,000 years after the coup, but you never know that there was the first center-left opposition party in Honduran history that had evolved out of the resistance called Libre, that its candidate, Xiomara Castro, may or probably won the election in 2013, and that Libre, along with the an opposition alliance, won the election, the candidate, Salvador Nasralla of the opposition alliance, including Libre, won the election a year ago. And so also just huge demonstrations in 2014 by the so-called indignados, or anti-corruption protesters, who were middle-class people, some of whom had supported the coup, finally having had enough with the post-coup corruption and protesting by the hundreds of thousands.
So I want to bring up what you just said, which is that there's been this sort of multi-pronged coalition that even sort of cross-class activism, cross-racial activism. What is keeping the government of Juan Orlando Hernandez in power right now? So we talked about the role of the United States in supporting the coup in 2009. How is the United States continuing to support the government there? Is it political support? Is it financial support? Is it doing engaged in the training of military forces and more?
It's all of the above. I mean, certainly there is some funding, about $65 million in funding for the Honduran government at different levels, so maybe as much as $100 million. And I would underscore that we don't know because it's not transparent. The defense budget is not transparent. But certainly there's military funding and security funding, which means training equipment for the police, and both of which kill people with impunity. And so that there's that direct funding. There's also a so-called development funding, which, will, again, not very transparent, but often goes into the coffers of the elite. But the bigger level is the legitimation of the regime by the U.S. government, and the U.S. recognizing the outcome of the stolen election, acting like Juan Orlando Hernandez is a legitimate president when his whole presidency is a violation of the Honduran constitution. Again, John Kelly saying Juan Orlando Hernandez is a great guy and a good friend. It's this kind of behavior by the United States government that keeps that regime in power. But, you know, the EU also supports it. Spain supports it. It's not just the United States. And Canada supports it. There are a lot of major investments, both in mining and in textiles, by Canadian transnationals. So it's
so there's corporate interests there.
Yeah, it's corporate interests, but, you know, it's more clear in the case of Canada. In the case of the United States, it's actually more geopolitical, but also just keeping that basic climate for transnational exploitation in place in the whole region. The U.S. doesn't have a lot of allies left. That's why it's so locked down on Honduras all these years. Doesn't want to give it up. And a lot of the economic activity is extraction of minerals and hydroelectric dams and part of these long-term projects for energy generation that will get sending it north to the United States. So it's not as simple as like in the old days of supporting United Fruit when the U.S. would dominate Latin Central America. And there's certainly U.S. banana companies down there, but it's really more a geostrategic thing as part of this new Cold War with China, although there is no Chinese presence that I know of in Honduras, no Chinese government presence. It's a large geopolitical agenda in service to transnational capitalism, and anybody who challenges that is then becomes a threat. So you get someone like Berta Cáceres. People may have heard of her, who was a famous and beloved and amazing indigenous and environmental activist in Honduras, and she and the Lenca people in Copin, their organization, have been fighting a hydroelectric dam in Honduras, and she was assassinated. We know there's now the people were just convicted, but not the people who actually called the killing, but the people who carried it out, including director of military intelligence at the time, and also employees of the dam company, assassinated her in 2016 because of her work opposing a dam. So you can see what part of the story here is also that the resistance gets beaten down because they're literally being killed. Like, it's not like you can go right to your congressperson in Honduras. You know, the congress people are either corrupt or disempowered, and the presidential election was stolen. And if you try to peacefully demonstrate, the police and military now use live bullets. Starting a year ago, they didn't even do that after the coup. They use live bullets with impunity and have killed dozens of people since the election. So, you know, what is it that when you start thinking about why people are fleeing north under such terrible circumstances, it's like, what is it people expect them to do? I mean,
Right. I mean, I'm looking at the website of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. It's a right-wing anti-immigrant website, and they have a piece called "Hondurans Broke Their Own Country. Now They're Headed Here." And I mean, it just is mind-boggling to me to hear these narratives that completely ignore all of the outside interests and internal interests and the connections between them, centered on this Central American nation, and ordinary Hondurans are just expected to sit there and take it and not fight back and not flee. But they're doing both. They're fighting back and fleeing, right?
And when they try to fight back, they then get killed or beaten up or jailed by a repressive government supported by the United States, by a military funded by the United States, by police trained and getting equipment from the United States. So and also one of the things that U.S. funded Border Patrol is doing in Honduras is or has arming the U.S. excuse me, arming the Honduran Guatemalan border so that Hondurans can't escape from their own country. And even some folks in Washington that people might think of liberals about Honduras, like WOLA, have actually supported funding the Honduran border security forces so people can't leave their own countries. And there's a lot of conversation about the wall in the United States, but it's very scary. They use dogs to hunt down women and children. And this is funded by the United States, this kind of border entrapment down there. So I don't know what people expect people to do. I mean, main thing to understand, these are refugees from a U.S. policy supporting the government, and the answer is not pour a lot of money in for them to for so-called economic development. But well, you're just pouring more money into thieves and people that kill people and policies that not only destroy people's bodies, but they're destroying the Honduran environment really rapidly with palm oil production, with these dams, with all kinds of with mining projects. So it's also like a it, this question of somehow they're to blame. I mean, I think it's really hard because then how do you fix this? But you certainly don't support that government, and you try to support democracy in Honduras, so Hondurans do have a path forward. Because when they try, they're killed.
And I'm wondering, Dana, if you can also give us a sense of the international solidarity between US-based activists and Honduran activists. You mentioned, there are some democratic lawmakers that are trying to do the right thing. The United States has a really inspiring history of doing solidarity work in Central America in the 80s in particular. Are we seeing a sort of resurgence of these international solidarity activists taking it upon themselves to do solidarity work with their Honduran brothers and sisters?
It's been a very beautiful thing, and I talk about it a lot in the book. And I would underscore it's not just in the United States, it's in Europe, and it's in Australia, it's in Canada, it's in Mexico, it's in El Salvador, it's all over the place. And so it's not just a US thing. In the book, I do just talk about the US side because that's what I was part of. But there's been this whole movement that came up immediately from the day of the coup. And, I think it took folks a while to find each other and see it together. But it's been an amazing thing to watch that solidarity movement come together and have a lot of success. I mean, at one point, there were 94 members of the House a few years ago that said stop police and security aid. And the Congress doesn't just wake itself up. I mean, that's enormous grassroots organizing by all different kinds of folks, not Hondurans first and in the U.S. first and foremost, but also a lot of Salvadorans, people in the folks in the faith movement, folks in the long-term solidarity groups locally. The AFL-CIO has been wonderful at every turn and endorsed this demand. A lot of faith-based people, the Sisters of Mercy of the Americas in particular. So it's been an amazing thing to be part of, and part of what I wanted to do with the book was put that down for the historical record, as well as the historical record of what the United States has done.
With this incredible resistance movement on the ground in Honduras that we talked about earlier, and this international solidarity trying to push US legislators into doing the right thing, what are your hopes for the political future of Honduras? Because things have to change. People can't take it for much longer. And it sounds like there are the ingredients for something positive to transpire in the next few years.
Well, the Honduran people are calling right now for a new election, as they have for a year. And And especially since the president's brother was just arrested in Miami for major arms trafficking and drug trafficking as well as arms trafficking. And that just sort of underscores the level of corruption and military and in the Honduran, not just in the Honduran military and police, but at the very top of the government. His brother Tony is a Congress member. There are other Congress members that are being charged, and a lot of allegations about the president's own links to drug trafficking, as well as his documented vast corruption. I think first and foremost, we listen to the Hondurans. They're calling for a new election. There's this convergence against continuity, which is a new coalition of grassroots groups. There are a whole lot of different groups that are calling for this right now. I'm looking for links between across different sectors. So I want to support that as well as all the local struggles that are going on all the time. You know, at the U.S. end, it's not like the Democrats are going to come riding into the rescue because they control the House. It's going to really depend on pressure, particularly from the Progressive Caucus, because there are certainly centrists that want to keep supporting Juan Orlando, but fighting corruption somewhat to clean it up somewhat. And that's more the position of Elliot Engel, who's head of foreign affairs, and Norma Torres from Los Angeles is part of this, you know, sort of just to the left of center, let's work with the State Department to work with the Honduran government to clean themselves up. Whereas this bloc led by Jan Schakowsky, Keith Ellison in the past, who's out now, but you know, there's been this other really major, beautiful coalition, and we've got some great people coming in the Progressive Caucus that are going to be wonderful. Certainly Ilhan Omar from Minneapolis is already taking an important role. I think Premila Jayapal, just from Seattle, who's not new now anymore, but Progressive co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, just went to the border. I think she's going to be looking at root causes. And so, but they don't, you know, they're doing it because, you know, they also hear from their constituents. And, you know, I was never a person before the coup, I was not a person who said, call your Congress member. And now, you know, I talk to aides to senators who will say, if I could just get five calls from my constituents, I would do that. Now,
wow.
You know, of course, the senators are a lot harder to move, but there's a lot of senators that understand this doesn't work and are looking at it differently because of immigration. So I really want to encourage everybody and all your organizations to pressure your Congress members right now, working through the Progressive Caucus collectively, but individually, and put that pressure on Pelosi, who may be pushing, you know, maybe more progressive now than when she's going to be, once she's Speaker again. And you know, I really want to encourage everybody to do that, because that's what's going to make a difference. And also push the Senate to keep doing more. And I want to underscore that it does make a difference. And it's sort of a two-pronged strategy in Congress. On the one hand, trying to do things that keep the Hondurans alive to fight another day. And there was just a very beautiful letter led by Senator Markey and Congresswoman Schakowsky in October, with 13 senators and I think 38 members of Congress protesting the repression of journalists and human rights observers in Honduras, including international observers. And things like that are happening, but they do it. It happens because of pressure from below.
Well, Dana, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and really shedding light on this issue, putting it in a broader context that's so desperately needed. Good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Dana Frank is a professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's the author of numerous books. We've been discussing her latest one. It's called The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.